Okay, and we are live. Hi, everybody. excuse me. I'm sorry that we started a little late today. Had an unexpected dental appointment, so I'm glad that we kept our Monday appointment no matter what. And we are continuing with our discussion of Pirkei Avot, the first chapter, a discussion of it's religious and it's historical and all kinds of other implications. So we are still on chapter 1, Mishnah Yud, and we're discussing the one of the later pairs of the leaders of the world of Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law, in the high period of the Second Temple, meaning around the year 100, maybe 90 BCE. We're talking about Shemaya and Avtalion. I'm sorry, a little bit later, actually. We're in the 60s already. Shemaya and Avtalion, both of whom are interesting in the fact that both of them were converts or the children of converts, which says a lot about the fluidity of a Jewish society at the time, and that people came from other civilizations were able to make it to the top. And we saw when we were talking about Shemaya said the following, Ehovet Amlacha, love work, we talked about that last week at length, Usna et Rabbanut, and hate the Rabbanut. We have to define what Rabbanut means. It doesn't necessarily mean the rabbinate. It doesn't necessarily mean certainly not the chief rabbinate of the state of Israel, because they didn't know anything about that. But according to most versions, al titvada l'rashut, don't get in too cozy with the authorities. So the truth of the matter is that many historians think that all three parts of this parish go together. What Shmai was basically telling us to do, or telling his students to do, is make an honest living, get a trade, buy a farm. We're talking about a period in which Jews are still pretty much agriculturalists. Make an honest living from the sweat of your brow. Work is a wonderful thing, and it makes you feel independent, and so on. Usnat the Rabbanut, don't get involved in. No, so what's the in? So some historians, my colleague and friend Gudzev Safrai, who put out the wonderful, I recommend this very highly, this Mashnat Eretz Yisrael series, which is published by Herzog, actually, which is a combination of scholarship and history and thought, and it's on all of them. He has it on all of the Mishnayot right now. He's putting out the other volumes, but the volume on Pirkei Avot is really excellent. He says, look at, you're talking about a period in which Jews are, the Jewish government in Judea and in the Galil is pretty much in the hands of collaborators with the Romans. The Romans have already taken over. I said that anyway, that I was wrong before. We were talking about the 60s. After the Roman takeover, when Herod is in charge or others are in charge, and he says, you're never going to come out of there. You're not going to come out of their hole. You're not going to come out of there honest, because politics corrupts. So basically, he's saying, don't go into politics. Don't go in. Don't try to find yourself a place in the ruling establishment, because it's not going to end well. And that is, in fact, interestingly, so the word Rabbanut comes from the word authority. Don't suck up to the authorities. Don't try to get a cheap sinecure. Make an honest living, and that goes together with the what we spoke about last week about the fact that there is this sense that people that are scholars should separate their scholarly pursuits and their Torah pursuits from the way they make a living. In other words, stay away from the establishment. The establishment is corrupting. We'll see then in a minute that that's going to be problematic. The truth of the matter is that the in general, the whole issue of getting involved with politics and representing the people is a mixed. It's a mixed bag because on the one hand you hope to do the best, but I know plenty of people. I mean, I think we all know, if those of us who are Israelis know, a lot of people in politics who, at the end, sort of were sorry that they got involved. On the other hand, it really is a there really is something very very important to serve the people and to try to provide use governmental tools to be able to provide to people with what they need. It's very much a mixed bag. Partly, I think, one of the issues that Shmaya was facing, and maybe because he knew the non-Jewish world well, it may very well be that a part of his hesitation, or part of his, it's not a hesitation to say, usnat harabanut means hate what you're doing, don't do it at all. It may very well be that Shmaya was referring to the fact that the specifically Hellenistic Roman system of government was corrupting. I mean, it's not that all political systems are corrupting, or there's obvious potential corruption everywhere, but the specific way that the Romans ran things, with bribery and with sexual harassment, we would call it today, but sexual favors that are frequently exchanged, and the type of moral morass that they saw in Judea and in Rome. I mean, anybody who watches, for example, if you want to get a good sense of this, you can watch the old series of I, Claudius with Derek Jacobi, which is available on YouTube. It's a wonderful series, and it even though it's dramatized, obviously, it gives you a good sense of what Roman historians said when they talked about the seamy side of Roman political life. So, interestingly, okay, so that's as far as the initial context of that Mishnah is concerned. What's striking is that if you'll take a look at the history of the way in which, this Mishnah has been interpreted, that line of interpretation holds. In other words, maybe it's a sort of a kal vachomer on a fortiori. In other words, medieval scholars, when they reach this, say usnat harabanut, don't coddle up to the Gentile authorities with whom we have to deal. In other words, you want to be the representative of the Jewish community to the king, to the duke, to the bishop, whatever the case may be. That's one thing. But don't get seduced away. Don't get seduced away by the dark side of the force, because ultimately that's going to play very badly. So it okay. Now, if you put, however, as many Mephorshim do, ehavatam lacha usnata rabbanut, that you should have your own source of income, and then you go, you do your political thing without hope of any kind of return, that'll raise something else. Because then you can't be corrupted. Here's to say about rich people should go into politics because they can't be bought. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but there is this sort of sense that you want to try to, if you have to do it, you have to do it, and you should do it in a way which is going to save your soul as much as possible. I wish I had a dollar for every single memoir of every single, at least medieval. I don't read modern modern memoirs, but I wish I had a dollar for every single, shekel. I wish I had 5 shekel for every single medieval memoir which the king or the duke or whoever sits there and says, "I'm sorry, I had to do this because I put my immortal soul at risk." And I think that's part of what we're just saying here. In other words, usnat harabanut, not that the political gesture is necessarily bad, but be very wary of the downside, of the corruptibility, or the corruptibility which you can feel in that context. Okay. And I think that we don't have to really, I don't think we have to go far. All of us know, have firsthand experience with what I'm discussing. Now, more interestingly, okay, so because I told you, I think in the first shiur, that one of the things about studying the commentaries on Pirkei Avot that's really, really fascinating is that different generations, in fact, viewed viewed the words differently. They always saw them through the lens of their time. So we'll take the, so for example, let's take the, and this one provides us with an example. When people would go and be shtadlanim, they would become representatives of the community. They would get into bed with the authorities, maybe even for a good reason. It wasn't just a matter that they would be corrupt, might be corrupted financially, and might betray their mission. There's more to it than that. Because at the end of the day, if you go and you live far too much time among non-Jews and get away from your community, you might end up converting to the other religion. And that, too, was a serious, serious concern. One of the interesting contrasts, I'll give an example from Spain. In the Muslim era in Spain, from, say the 10th century, Muslims conquered Spain in 711, and the Muslims are, and the great so-called golden age in Spain, which I don't think really existed, but that's for another talk. The so-called golden age in Spain goes from about 950 to 1148. During that period of time, you have a significant number of Jewish courtiers. Now, these courtiers are people of incredible religious, intellectual integrity, and they represent the Jewish community, and they provide very, very serious services for the rulers of the various city-states. They're called Taifa kings of southern Spain. That's another one. And among them are some of the greatest leaders of the Jewish people, people that sponsored or on their own actually made tremendous contributions to Jewish civilization, people like Chasdai ibn Jabrut and Shmuel HaNagid, who are not just streets in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, they actually were people. And yet they maintained their integrity religiously. Once Jews move over to the Christian side, it's very interesting, you find that the moral and the religious integrity of these courtiers goes down. They are subject to withering criticism on the part of Jewish moralists, of rabbis, who find that their comportment is absolutely deplorable. They accuse them of all kinds of things, of oppressing the Jews in order to suck up to the Christian rulers, or they accuse them of keeping concubines and of both Jewish and non-Jewish. They accuse them of horrible, horrible things. So the question is, what happened? So first of all, it's interesting in that regard that you find that the we don't have time in a half hour here to do this, but if you take a look at those Sephardic commentaries on Pirkei Avot, who are writing during the Muslim period, the way that they discuss Usnata Rabbanut is a little bit more tempered than afterwards. Later, it gets intense, and I think that's a response to the reaction of moralists and people who write on Pirkei Avot. Of course, they're going to be are by definition moralists because it's a moral tract, right? Get much more intense, much more aggressive, much sharper, and I think it reflects the different types of comportment of those Jews who actually went into Rabbanut in the sense of going into positions of authority. Now you might want to know, why was it that there was such a shift in the moral fiber of the people who went into politics or went into representing Jewish people and serving the local kings between the Christian and the Muslim period? Hard to say. There is one thing is clear. Those who were the greatest courtiers in the Muslim period were also great scholars. They were people of tremendous piety. They were people of tremendous standing, and they were people who were very much aware of the fact that they were on a mission. The Jews who became courtiers later were not of the same caliber intellectually, not of the same caliber religiously, not of the same caliber culturally, and that may very well be responsible for the difference. I point out the fact that when Ferdinand and Isabella issued their But the edict of expulsion from Spain on March 31st, 1492, all of their Jewish courtiers converted to Christianity, except for Don Yitzhak Abravanel. There's a rumor that they wanted Abravanel to stay, and they said, you can stay Jewish even though you stay. So he says, well, what am I going to do? I'm going to be here all alone. So he left. In any event, but that's so this identification of Usnata Rabbanut with political or political office or appointed office or getting too much in the good graces of the secular government, of the non-Jewish government, and with the temptations that come with that, that's actually the predominant line of interpretation. However, and here we come back to what we talked about last week. However, from the 19th century on, the word Rabbanut all of a sudden starts meaning the rabbinate. Love Malacha, hate the rabbinate. Don't go into the Rabbanus. Don't go in the Rabbanut. So, what happened? Why? I mean, the people who wrote, people like, for example, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, the student of the Vilna Gaon who founded the first modern real yeshiva, he wrote his parish at the beginning of the 19th century. He makes it clear that the Usnata Rabbanut refers to the rabbinate serving as a rabbi. His truth is almost identical attitude is registered among, of all things, Hasidim, especially the Kotzke Rebbe, or Menachem Mendel Morgenstern. According to what happened, they were very well aware of the fact that the previous tradition of interpretation referred to government service. So what happened? So in order to be able to understand this, we need to go back a little bit and continue a line of discussion we started last week. And that is, where did we get the rabbinate? Where does the whole idea of the rabbinate come from? So first of all, let's see what the rabbinate is and what the rabbinate isn't. As Safrai says in his commentary to Avot that I showed you, which I showed you a few minutes ago, it's not possible that Shemaya had in mind Usna et Rabbanut means don't serve as a rav. It's not possible. It's not possible because the highest level of what's the greatest mitzvah? The greatest mitzvah is Talmud Torah, and a built-in part of Talmud Torah is teaching. It's not just learning; it's teaching. If you're capable of teaching and you don't, then you really you're like a prophet who withholds the prophecy that was given by God. You've actually betrayed your own personal mission. This is especially true of people like Shemaya, who were part of the Prushim, part of the Pharisees, whose number one priority was the breaking of the priestly elite of priestly monopolies, rather, the elitist monopoly in Talmud Torah and the teaching of Torah to everybody, whether you're born a rich priest or whether you were born the son of a farmer, it doesn't matter. And that was one of the major achievements of the Prushim, was to say that Torah belongs to everybody. In fact, it was the Prushim, the people to whom Shemaya and Avtalion belonged, that created the first real public school system for Jews, that everybody should get a major education. Now, at least all boys, and girls learned as well, by the way, not as much, but certainly all boys, no matter what their social standing. In fact, part of the ramifications of the Maccabean revolt, which we'll talk about next week, is in fact this push for universal literacy, not in the sense of just read and write, but of knowledge. In any event, so it's not possible Usnata Rabbanut means don't become a teacher. So what does it mean? So there has always been a tremendous, from the time of Chazal on, a tremendous, not just hesitation, but a tremendous dislike of the idea of taking money for Torah. There are many, many statements of Chazal, there are many, many midrashim, in which the rabbis say that the Torah has to be for free. The prophets compare the Torah to water, and just as water is free, or should be free, although my water meter doesn't testify to that. Similarly, Torah should be for free. You should make your own money. You should make your own living, and teach Torah for free. Now, the truth of the matter is that, from a structural point of view, not taking money for Torah is also smart. If you want to be an authority, the worst thing in the world to do is to take money for it, because then you become an employee. If you want to be a leader, you should be independently, not independently wealthy, but you should not take money from the person who you are supporting. I remember many years ago having a long talk with Rabbi Lam Zecher Tzadik Livracha, when I was still a student at UIU, and I told him, I think that instead of taking a master's in philosophy or a master's in Jewish history, I think every single rabbi who graduates YU should get an MBA. He said, man, I'm crazy. I said, look it. The rabbinate, the way it's structured, is a lose-lose proposition. It can't work. Because you can't be an authority figure, and you can't be a father figure, and take money from the people over whom you're supposed to take a salary from the people over whom you're supposed to exert authority, or for the people you're going to pastor. We don't pay our parents' salary. On the contrary, we go to our parents for money when we're younger. Right? So it undermines the very essence of the type of status and standing that a rabbi is supposed to have. I've seen other Mefarshim said, Ehavatam Lucha Smata Rabbanut means love your trade, because that makes it possible for you to be able to be a Rav, able to teach Torah, by being independent. So Chazal were really, really, so, and principle, and also for practical purposes, what I'm just saying is really not my chiddush. It's not my novel interpretation. So rabbis on both sides of the aisle, both Sephardim and Ashkenazim, were incredibly allergic to the idea of a professional rabbinate. Ironically, the person who was most emphatic about this was Maimonides, who over and over, I read the passage last week to you, goes over and over in a number of occasions, talks about how taking money for Torah is a terrible, terrible thing. Ironically, because there was actually a tradition to pay teachers of Torah and to institutionalize the rabbinate in Spain. It starts with the Geonim, with the heads of the yeshiva in Baghdad in the late ancient world, early Middle Ages. That's already a business in terms of how we call it. But you're talking about the 8th century, 9th century, 10th century, 11th century. But even there, the value of having rabbis be independent, I don't know what that means, was acknowledged. Among the Ashkenazim, it was an absolute axiom. I mentioned last week Rabbeinu Tam's comment that making a living may be more important than studying Torah and teaching Torah, because it's the basis upon which makes everything else possible. And up until the 14th century, there was no professional rabbinate in anywhere in the Ashkenazic world. Period. Everybody made a living some other way. Rashi was a business person. He was not a vintner. It's another story. Rashi made a living as a business person. Rabbeinu Tam, his grandson, was apparently he lended interest. He was a very wealthy man, apparently. Everybody did something else. And the idea was that you donate your time for Torah, and that actually enhanced your standing in the community. Now, as it happened, the traditional Ashkenazic position was also that the people who led the community should also be scholars. So you have sort of like, you didn't have a sharp division between laity and scholars, between rabbis and balabatim, the way that you have later. And it seems to have worked. And it seems to have worked very, very nicely. So, ahavit amlacha, make a living. Usnat the rabbanut, don't make the rabbin into a profession. When did this change? This changes begins to change already in the early 14th century, but it really comes to a head in the second half of the 14th century. 1348-49, the Black Death comes to Europe, wipes out between 50 and 70% of the European population. How many Jews died is a question. It's something of a question, but it's certainly percentage-wise as many Jews died as non-Jews did. However, more importantly for our purposes, is that the entire large swaths of the intellectual elite of the rabbis of Eastern of Germany and of Central Europe, what's today the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Austria, and so on. Either died in the plague or actually were murdered because the Jews were accused of responsibility for the plague, whether it's because they corrupted the air or they poisoned the wells or whatever the case might be. Either way, when Ashkenazic Jews tried to reconstruct their lives in the second half of the 14th century, they found themselves without leaders. And that led to a situation in which, when there's a vacuum, vacuums fill. So people who weren't qualified entered into the field. There's a story that's told. A similar situation in the United States, for example, during the 19th century. Small communities started in the Midwest and the Far West, and they needed people to guide them. Shochtim, this, that, and the other thing, to be rabbis. So people, if you knew how to read Hebrew, so you became the rabbi, even though you weren't qualified to be the rabbi. But, you know, if there's a need, so you settle for whatever you can get. So similarly here, all kinds of half-baked and not qualified people went in because there was a call and there was money. And I'm sorry, there was a call. So the question is how do you deal with that? So as a result of this decline in qualified scholars, first of all, for the first time in Jewish history, there was an attempt to try to regularize and to standardize qualifications for the rabbinate. And the idea developed among the Ashkenazim that if you want to be a Rav, then you have to pass a test, series of tests, with a rabbi who is recognized as authority, and he gives you a piece of paper, says you can be a rabbi, you're qualified. That is what is today called smicha. The smicha that rabbis get today from yeshivas or for private rabbis, whatever the case might be, that comes from then. It's called the Hatarat Torah. It's a diploma. It's like a diploma, and historians have long discussions of whether, in fact, the inspiration came from the universities in Europe, which at the time were coming into their own. So you begin to get a cadre of people who are professionals going into communities where there's a need, and it's almost willy-nilly that they ask for salary. In general, in the first stages, they weren't even given money. They were given monopolies. Okay, we won't give you money because you can't give money for Torah, but you can have a monopoly on shiduchim. Or you can have it, which a lot of famous rabbis were shadchanim. There was a singles problem, yes, in the there was singles and divorce problem, interesting, in Germany and in Central Europe, throughout Central Europe, in the 14th and 15th centuries. And the rabbis were the shadchanim, and they took money for whatever, for all kinds of services. Later on, it became a matter of either getting a monopoly on selling certain things in the community, like yeast, salt, whatever the case might be. But slowly but surely, the rabbinate became a profession, which came with a salary. And immediately there's complaints. Immediately there are complaints that rabbis are arrogant, that people are more interested in the title than they are in studying. There's an interesting statement by Rabbi Yisrael Isserlein in the 15th century in Germany, the leading rabbinic authority of the age. He died in 1460, which is Rabu Anil Anismachim Benitmadu Mitnitmatu Alomdim. That there's lots of people who have smicha, but there's very few people who know how to learn. So it became a matter of covet. It became a matter of status. It became a matter of lording it over other people, and not a matter of context. So the rabbinate, from the minute it became established, exposed itself to, we're coming back to the original, corruption, whether it was moral corruption, whether it was lording it over the people, whether it was a matter of politics, whether it was a matter of families and dynasties, and whatever the case might be. And the cry goes up that this institution that we've created in order to have some kind of quality control actually is not only not fulfilling its destiny, it's not fulfilling its task, it's actually corrupting. And this goes on consistently until we get to the 19th century, when the rabbinate starts really, really going downhill. Now there are great rabbanim. I'm not saying there aren't. There are great rabbanim, and then there are great beshivim. But in terms of as a phenomenon, there is the complaints about the petty politics and the detachment of people who are professionals and wander from place to place. So they don't really put down roots in any specific town. Sometimes becomes a serious issue. And it's against that background, already in the early 19th century, that you have the statement by Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Interestingly, he had a yeshiva. So what's he training people to be? He wants them to teach Torah. So how do you negotiate that? So he writes as follows. Ve'amar usnata rabbanut. It says, hate the rabbinate. Ki barabbanut usrara nafochu. If you get into power and you can lord it over people, you easily are seduced into immoral or corrupt activity. You can't live without rabbis uparnasim, or people that are going to leave the communities. But you have to make sure you're not seduced by the dark side. Sometimes a guy has to be a rab because there's a need. But if you accept such a position, you should go into it because you're compelled to, because you can't make a living any other way, or because you have a mission. Aval birtzono yisnata rabbanut litparnes mize. Even if you're going to serve as a rav, find another way to make a living, because it can lead to abuses. And also because it undermines your own position, as I said before. V'ehav yoteret hamelacha. You're better off loving the work, loving making your own living. And in fact, some of the greatest rabbinic figures of the 19th century took this advice and actually were independent business people and devoted themselves to Torah. And then he adds a beautiful word. He says he just adds a sort of a. This is not what it means, but it's a lovely interpretation. Valderech tzachut. He continues. Yitpare. Sort of like a serendipitous kind of interpretation. Valderech tzachut yitparesh ehovet amlacha nimshach le rabbanut. That the two parts of the passage go together. Ehovet amlacha usnat the rabbanut. When both parts are talking about teaching Torah. Ehovet amlacha. Love the substance of being a rabbi. Love the substance of serving your people. Love the substance of teaching Torah. The melechet harabbanut, what a rabbi is supposed to do, what a Torah teacher is supposed to do, and today we would include women talmidot chachamim as well. Usnat the rabbanut, but don't go in it for the covet, and don't go in it for the money, and don't go in it for the achnasa geld, and don't go in it because you want to lord it over people, and don't get seduced by the dark side, because that ultimately undermine the melechet harabbanut, the real mission that's involved. So that you find, I'm not going to go into, when I said hate the rabbinate as the title, I'm not going to go into a long harangue about the Israeli chief rabbinate, although I could. I have lots of things to say about it. I think everybody can apply the lesson on their own. But you see here that the tension between malacha and whether it's politics, whether it's communal activity, whether it's actually more narrowly conceived the rabbinate, which was underlined by or outlined by Shemaya in this Mishnah, has a permanent dynamic of the as to the the fact that it's preferential status of making your own living and having your own amount of personal dignity and not exploiting a system, but if you're going to go into it, do it for selfless reasons, and that you can be more effective that way as well, and more credible as well, and carries over to the attitude towards rabbinic authority or Jewish authority in the late Middle Ages, in the modern period, and today. Okay, guys. So next week it's going to be Hanukkah, and we are going to talk about Hanukkah. And I urge you to join us. I am doing a podcast this evening. I can't remember what the name of the podcast is, but I am doing a podcast tonight. You can look at my Facebook page to see where it's going to be. 8 o'clock to 10 on the Hanukkah on Hanukkah. I will not repeat or largely not repeat next week what I'm going to say there. You're all invited. Please tune in. I assume that they'll put it up on a recording up afterwards, but it's always fun to do live. If you have questions, let me know. If you want to follow me on Twitter or Facebook, Vakasha, you're invited. And I look forward to seeing you next week. I assume you're starting with the Sufganiyot or Spinge already Thursday night. So Chag Urim Sameach, as we say here in Israel.